Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. By 2012, the top 10% in this country was taking home over half of all income, the highest proportion since 1913. Our guest also reminds us of the falling corporate taxes in this country, 6% of U.S. GDP in the 50s, and now 1.6% in 2010. Corporations contributing less money to pay for the U.S. infrastructure. Poverty in 2012, roughly 47 to 50 million Americans were living in poverty. Predatory loans, two storefront loan shops for every one Starbucks location in the United States. They're part of the $30 billion industry. Our guest is the author of Plutocracy in America, How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the Poor. And he calls for specific things that need to happen in the United States to really address this problem of inequality. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Ronald Formisano. Ronald is William Bryan Chair of American History and Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Kentucky. He's also the author of The Tea Party, A Brief History, and For the People, American Populist Movements from the Revolution to the 1850s. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Formisano, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for calling me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you. This really is an amazing figure that I started the show, and you say early on in your book, the top 10%, and we can talk about the top 0.01% too, which is taking, you know, huge portion of this portion, top 10% taking home over half of all income, highest proportion since 1913. Isn't that incredible?
Well, it's staggering, and so is the degree of inequality in this country and how it permeates the whole society. When I started this project, I really had no idea of the extent to which the obvious ways inequality worked. That was still had revelations for me, but then the hidden infrastructure in so many ways in which inequality just keeps on coming. And new material for this book, it's staggering, has come out weekly, almost on a daily basis. I just read in my newspaper this morning that for African-American families in Kentucky, their median income has dropped by 11%.
Oh, my goodness.
Since 2014. So, as I say, on an almost daily basis, and in terms of the CEO excessive compensation, one figure, I think it's in the book, you just mentioned half of all income, but 95% of the recovery, of income from the recovery, the top 1%.
Hmm.
And so, and wages remain stagnant.
Yes.
The workers without a high school education, they have lost 20 in the period from something like 1985 to 2013. They've lost 20% of their income. Workers with a high school education have lost about, I think it's 13 or 15% of their income in that period. So wages are being squeezed continuously. In fact, the day of the Republican debate, the Census Bureau reported that poverty remained the same as the previous year. And the sad thing to me was that those folks on the stage in the Reagan Library really didn't talk about inequality. And there was hope a month or so ago that it was entering the Republican campaign. Certainly Bernie Sanders has been hammering away at it.
Yes.
And Hillary Clinton has been, and I think she would have even without Bernie sort of pressuring from the left. But it's just a crushing, it's crushing a lot of people. And you mentioned the 46 to 50 million there are also a few million near poverty that just struggle to make ends meet. And they're not just in Appalachian hollows. They're not just in the Mississippi Delta. They're not just in urban ghettos. They're out in the suburbs, too. Mm-hmm. They're out in the suburbs. Millions of near poor. And that's the situation we face.
When you say in the book that the federal government's tender concern for Wall Street at the expense of Main Street, can you tell me what you mean by that? How has the federal government coddled Wall Street?
Oh, my. Well, first of all, 15% tax on hedge fund capital gain income. And Warren Buffett says that 30-some people in his office pay more income tax than he does, you have some plutocrats, very wealthy, very reactionary people start screaming about that, and they think somehow their rights are being infringed upon. But the fact of the matter is it's a very unfair tax system. And you just mentioned the corporate tax structure and how corporate contribution to the national treasury has declined since the 1950s. Well, who's picking up the slack? The middle class. The middle class and even low-income people are picking up the slack. There's a revolving door between Wall Street and the federal government, and no matter who is in office, and I'm not one of those people who thinks, well, it doesn't matter who you elect. It does matter because you've got things like Supreme Court appointments, foreign policy, a whole range of things. And I have to give Obama credit for trying to chip away with especially federal workers. Federal workers are working on contracts funded by the federal government. He's made movements in terms of paid leave. He's upped the minimum wage to increase in a year or two. That's all chipping away. It's chipping away at this massive structure of inequality wherein CEOs, by various measures, get paid 400 times the average worker in their firm. Some of them get paid, by some measures, depending on the firms you're looking at, could be 265. But it was just revealed by some calculations by Dean Baker, who's a very respected economist, yes, a liberal economist at a Washington think tank, that Robert Iger, the chair of Disney, received $43.7 million last year, and the median worker received $19,530, which means that his ratio was 2,238 to 1.
Oh.
That's just ridiculous. Baker looked at about two dozen of these executives, and when he got near the bottom, it was something like 284 times the average worker. The guy who came in second was Nadella of Microsoft, and his pay package was 2,012 times the estimate of the 41,900 for the median employees' earnings at Microsoft. That's staggering, and it's ridiculous. And the same day that I saw a book review, $2 a Day. Have you seen that book?
Yes.
Yes. It was reviewed in the Times. And, you know, the same day that book was reviewed, I think there was an indication that the top hedge fund managers had not done so well as the year before. They had only pulled in just over $11
billion. Huh. Yeah,
yes.
They're hurting. Wouldn't you?
It's
think,
really not a laughing matter.
No,
though,
it's not. You would think, wouldn't you, Ron? I know this is perhaps a naive way of looking at it, but just on a human level, if you were making that much more of the people who were working with you, wouldn't you say, "Hey, guys and gals, I'm making a whole lot of money here. It's just not right. I feel kind of guilty about it. So, let me give
you
some."
some people will quarrel with the idea that it's immoral. Pope Francis has spoken strongly,
yes,
candidly, from the heart on this matter. I happen to agree with Pope Francis that there is a morality and an ethical issue at stake. But beyond that, how about the International Monetary Fund putting out reports by nonpartisan economists that it slows down growth, that it harms the entire economy?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that enough to somehow persuade some of these masters of the universe that maybe this system is rigged too much?
Whatever happened to the Occupy Wall Street movement? You talk about that erupting in the fall of 2011. The right and the left concerned about what was going on, the excessive gains of the inordinately wealthy. Is there a movement, or is it embodied primarily in the campaign of Bernie Sanders right now?
I think it performed a valuable service by calling attention to inequality. And really, inequality had been gaining traction as an issue, and public awareness was rising. And the latest polls have showed that even a majority of Republicans think that the way wealth and income is distributed in this country is wrong. Where Democrats and Republicans disagree is, well, how much should the government do about it? And let's go back to your question, which was
Occupy Wall Street.
I think they performed a valuable service in calling attention to it. And President Obama, late in his first term, and then far more in his second term, as I said before, has been chipping away at it and trying to do something about it. But much more needs to be done. My book is really more of an exposure. I don't pretend to know the way somebody like Robert Reich, who's written a book on this, or the Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz, they propose solutions. I keep my solutions pretty simple, and I think that there is historical precedent for a number one goal of having a government, and I know this is perhaps pie in the sky, but if we had a government that was committed to full employment, and that was something that Franklin Roosevelt talked about during the Second World War as it approached, the four freedoms, and one of them was freedom to get employment, and by that he meant that everyone should be working. And nothing enhances a life other than meaningful work, of course,
sure,
love and family,
mm-hmm,
and religion are important too, but meaningful work. I mean, Freud said love and work, and it's very important. And when all of these people who are underemployed, and let's face it, the unemployment rate of 5% is ridiculous. Kevin Phillips, the economist, has referred to that as Pollyanna creep, because over the past 20, 30 years, successive administrations have tried to make the unemployment figures look better. And so when people stop looking for work, and so many are in what some economists recently called, they're the shadow workers in sort of a shadowy non-economy. And they're lurking on the sidelines, and they're not counted. They're not counted. And those people have lost so much.
Right. Yeah, so many people have. It's interesting that you start your book, and here he is about to arrive in Washington, D.C. Well, what is it? 2:30? He's probably just arrived in Washington, D.C., the Pope. And you start your book with, and let me read just a portion of this, not the whole thing. Today we have to say, thou shalt not, to an economy of exclusion and inequality. Such an economy kills. How can it be that there is not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure but it is news when the stock market loses 2 points. This is a case of exclusion. Can we continue to stand by when food is thrown away while people are starving? This is a case of inequality. The Pope is going to speak to a lot of people, including Congress, on Thursday, and I'm sure that he will speak to that particular issue. Does that make a difference to hear him speak on that?
I hope
Congress?
So. I hope so. You know, I thought that, as I said earlier, that the Republicans would talk more about inequality. I'm still holding out hope for that. In fact, perhaps more hope than I hold out for them talking about climate change. And if I were to write my book again, I would have a new section on the interrelationship between climate change and inequality, because the Pope has said in his last encyclical, which came out after I completed writing the manuscript for this book, he called attention to the fact that hundreds of millions of the poorest and most vulnerable across the globe will be impacted most mm-hmm. by climate change. And we saw that recently with President Obama's visit to Alaska. There are 7 indigenous villages of Eskimo people, some of whom have lived in those places for centuries, and their water is rising, mm-hmm. the ice is breaking, and they can't hunt one of their principal sources of food, whales, and they have kind of an annual whale home. And they're not like the Japanese fleets that go out and just kill whales indiscriminately. Native peoples never did that. They didn't do that, of course, with the buffalo. It took us to go across the continent and wipe out the buffalo. And these native peoples, their villages are in danger of being washed away by rising water. So it's not just polar bears, it's some of the most vulnerable Americans. And other coastal communities in the future, and maybe some will be prosperous. I love this example of this gated community on Long Island that was totally self-sufficient, had its own police force, its own public works, water system, and it was devastated by Hurricane Sandy. And then what did they do? They turned to the state and federal government for help. And so their sort of withdrawal from civic society ended with catastrophe.
We are going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of Plutocracy in America, How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the Poor. Ronald Formisano is with us. He says that 14 things must happen to reduce economic inequality. And he cites a few of them. I'll cite a few of them now. Reverse Citizens United. Don't favor Wall Street over Main Street, eliminate corporate loopholes, raise the minimum wage, reduce local sales taxes, shift the tax burden away from low-income and middle-income people, strengthen labor unions, fix the public education system, motivate the middle class toward activism, which is probably one of the reasons that he wrote the book, and fighting voter suppression laws. They're just a few of his suggestions. Here is our phone number as we again address the issue of inequality and welcome your calls at 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you now. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Formisano is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Kentucky, and is also the author of The Tea Party, A Brief History, and For the People, American Populist Movements from the Revolution to the 1850s. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for our guest, and we start with Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Yes, hello. I wanted to add on something that the Pope said not too long ago, which is how he was relating the idea that young people are not finding jobs, this is not just in this country, but it's all across the world. But he attributes the rising in suicides, reliance on drugs, or turning to drugs, and then also, importantly, that people are, young people are turning to not just gangs, but actually joining organized groups such as we're seeing in Syria, and how, anyway, the idea is that these young people have nowhere to turn except to sometimes these drastic measures.
Professor?
Hello, yes. That's a very good, it's as much of a comment, I guess, as a question. And in my chapter on life and quality of life, which refers to the fact that the United States has what researchers call a health disadvantage, I discuss drugs, the drug industry, the huge industry of antidepressants in this country, what the Rolling Stones referred to as mother's little helper. I didn't even include the opioid epidemic, which the OxyContin epidemic, which has ravaged eastern Kentucky. I live in Kentucky. And I refer to a remarkable book, and you might be interested in it. It's called A Spirit Level, by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. And the subtitle is Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Healthier. And that's, I think that's in the Pope's message very much. Greater equality makes societies healthier, and greater inequality makes societies unhealthier. And Wilkinson and Pickett present a series of measures: mental health, all kinds of diseases, stress. They tick them off one after another, and they're very careful. And I say in the book that a long time ago, as a history graduate student, I tried to master statistics. I didn't. But I learned that a correlation is not a cause. But when you see one correlation after another piling up, as a famous historian once said, you don't need to know everything to know why. And unequal societies are not as healthy as societies with greater equality.
Thank you very much, Nancy, for the call. And yet we've heard from many, Professor Formosano, that we live in a land of great opportunity, that all you have to do, no matter what your background, is make sure that you study very hard, apply yourself, get as educated as you possibly can, be sure and go to college, and
right,
the world is open to you. You would say that's no longer
if only that
easy.
Were still true. If only that were still true. And I must say, rather grimly, that Horatio Alger is dead, and the American people are slowly waking up to that fact, because there's still a majority that thinks there's greater opportunity in this country, and yet all of the data points to the fact that our advanced peer countries have greater mobility than we do, with a couple of exceptions in Europe. And what demographers call stickiness exists in the United States. If you're born into the bottom fifth, the chances of your staying in that bottom fifth are enormous. And our education system is broken. Now, some of the top universities are trying to increase diversity, but the fact of the matter is that the wealthy overflow the most prestigious institutions, both the public ones and the private ones. And at the bottom, the number of what demographers call, education researchers call, apartheid schools, with high poverty and high concentrations of minorities, African Americans, Hispanics, Asians. And they're also called dropout factors. So at the bottom you have something like 1,500 apartheid schools. At the top you have elite private universities swamped by the affluent. You have tuition skyrocketing at public universities.
Yes.
Student debt over $1 trillion. Stanford researcher, Sean Reardon, has a wonderful phrase describing what he sees as the pyramid of American education right now. No rich child left behind. And it goes beyond just greater numbers of affluence, it, both in the elite private and public universities. The rich know how important it is to invest in education, and they're putting enormous resources into their children's education so that they, there have been studies done. Kids who are more involved in extracurricular activities, debate teams, French clubs, you name it, they tend to be the more affluent kids whose parents are investing more money in them. And our universities, unfortunately, especially public universities, have become corporatized. And 10, 15 years ago, no college president earned more than $1 million. And the fact that college administrators and college presidents are now starting to emulate the race to the top that goes on Wall Street and among CEOs is not good for education. The study that stands out in my mind is of the highest paid presidents at 25 universities, the 25 universities with the highest paid presidents. In the last 15 years, student debt at those universities exploded more than other universities and colleges, and they depended more on adjuncts, part-time, underpaid, no benefit. They're called the teachers on wheels, or the Rhodes Scholars, R-O-A-D-S, and the students are shortchanged, and it's such a telling study that those 25 best-paid presidents, student debt grew faster there, and they hired more adjuncts. So those presidents are being paid on the backs of the students and on the backs of the people at the bottom of the academic pyramid, higher education pyramid.
Jim in Lake Geneva, hi. Jim, turn the radio down, please.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, that's, I asked you to turn the radio down, please.
Oh.
Okay. Hello? Jim,
I'm here.
Yeah, go, all right, go ahead.
You hear me?
Yeah, Jim, please, go ahead.
Okay. I had the car on.
Yeah, let's wait till you get somewhere else, Jim, because we can barely hear you. I'm sorry. Let's go instead to Tom in Appleton. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Great conversation. Earlier in the conversation, the guest mentioned that some group, I think it was African Americans, had lost, I think, 11% of their income over a period of years. And that's a bad thing, of course. And I'd like to point out that you, Kathleen Dunn, and myself, a hardworking employee of a city in Wisconsin, and a public health nurse that was making $12 an hour, we lost 8% of our income overnight with the passing of Act 10, and that is part and parcel of the very processes that are being discussed here. They're straight out of the ALEC playbook, behind which you will see the smiling faces of David and Charles Koch and their ilk, and that we're tending to talk about this again, like, okay, this is going on in the world, but it's going on right here, and it's going on and happening to us. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom, very much for the call. Let's talk about not necessarily what happened in Wisconsin. You may not be all that familiar with it, but this issue of...
I am.
You are, okay.
I'd love to talk about Wisconsin.
All right, go ahead then. The stage
just
is yours.
Let me loose.
Go right ahead, Ron.
No, I'm ready. I'm ready. You know, I must tell you that a long, long time ago, I earned my master's degree in history at the University of Wisconsin.
Mm.
It had an outstanding history department. I believe it still does. And the reason I left was it was such an outstanding department. It was overrun with students. I was in a seminar with 60 people.
Hmm.
It wasn't my idea of a seminar.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to wait in line to see my very nice advisor, who I'm sure is long gone from this world. I'm still lucky to be in it myself. Anyway, Wisconsin is a state that, of course, as a historian, I've always admired, and I feel very sad about what's happened there. Recently, in 1959, it was the first state to recognize, I believe, public sector unions. And, of course, there's just been a war on them. And this gentleman who just called mentioned the Kochs. Well, the current governor, who just dropped out of the race, had a very powerful coalition of billionaires, of Americans for Prosperity, the Club for Growth, the Bradley Foundation. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Is it Grebe?
Grebe,
Michael Grebe, the head of the Bradley Foundation. Well, they backed this, your current governor, and they had a long-run plan, and I think it turned out better than they expected to really continue the war on unions. And as I say in my book, the American public, unfortunately, has amnesia when it comes to unions. There are unions that have done some bad things. I remember reading in the New York Times about these guys retired from the Long Island Railroad. I don't know if you ever saw that story. And they're standing on a golf course collecting $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year.
Yes.
After their feather-bedded jobs, they quit their feather-bedded jobs and all kinds of abuses. But you know what? No union has wreaked the economic damage on this country that Wall Street and financial institutions committed in 2008 and 2009. And building up to it by selling those fraudulent derivatives. And unions built the middle class. When I was in graduate school, I just referred to that. When I was in graduate school in the 60s, and I read a great deal of political science, and all political scientists talked about in those days when they talked about the American political system was the civic culture, a civic culture built on a strong middle class that participated, that was informed, and we've lost that. And the middle class is being hammered. And there's a direct correlation between the decline of unions, the war on unions, and the decline of the middle class. Unions make low-wage workers and comparable workers who aren't in unions, if they're in the same area, they can get more benefits. Unions lift up non-union workers as well as their own. And I would say that why has the middle class been shrinking? The middle class is smaller than it was 20, 30 years ago. And where are the people who are no longer in the middle class going? Well, some of them are going up, but more of them are dropping down. More of them are dropping down. And I do believe that the decline of unions has played a major role in that. And once again, the middle class was regarded as the bedrock of American democracy. And Americans have amnesia when it comes to realizing that unions played a big role from the 30s to the 40s to the 50s. That's what helped build the middle class. The National Labor Relations Act and the support that the unions got from the federal government protecting collective bargaining.
When you talk about things that must happen to reduce economic inequality, you mention unions and that you say that we need to strengthen unions, or at least those that are left, because there aren't all that many of them. How are those to be strengthened?
I'm sorry, how or what?
How do we strengthen unions?
I'm sorry, I still don't. Are you there?
Oh, can you not hear me?
Yeah, it's not, for some reason you weren't coming through very clearly. Could you repeat your question?
Yeah, you talk about 14 things that have to happen to reduce economic inequality, and one of them concerns unions. You say we need to strengthen labor unions. How is that to be done?
That's a very good question. I saw President Obama's Labor Day speech in Boston, and it was filled with pro-labor, pro-union rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And if only he had that on his agenda when he entered office, but he didn't. And I'm not sure that what's happening now is workers, here's where the hope lies, okay? And I think I do mention this in the book very briefly. The hope is that many workers are realizing they can organize and they don't need to form a union. And they can form coalitions with other workers to get better pay, to get benefits, to get workplace safety regulations, which have been part of the war on unions, and they don't need to form a union. And there's been a good deal of that activity across the country, and it's happening with, and I do mention this in the book, it's happening with many fast food workers who are protesting, demonstrating, walking out for higher pay, and I won't get off the topic and talk about the welfare queens, Walmart and McDonald's, but fast food workers are not teenagers. Many of them are 25 and older. 17% of them, or something like that, are teenagers, and of course that's the bromide that you hear. 70% of the American people want the minimum wage raised. And one of the Republican candidates mentioned that. Ben Carson had a rather radical proposal. He wanted it indexed to inflation. He said, so we'll never have this conversation again. And that was pretty interesting. But, of course, nobody else agreed with it. Mm.
Let's go to more phone calls. Jim, now, I hope we have connected in Lake Geneva. Hi.
I am hearing you loud and clear. I was caught between technologies.
Well, now you're here.
My iPhone and my sink in my car. Yes, I'd like to tell you about last week when I turned the TV on and heard the Archbishop of Chicago coming and speaking from Labor Hall, the Plumbers Hall in Chicago, and speaking to the workers and speaking about workers. Speaking about unions, and I have not heard that. I heard that in my youth, and I'm an 80-year-old retired carpenter, a union carpenter, and probably the ones that probably at the peak of the times in the 50s. But I see a lack of that, and I wonder how many people do have amnesia. You mentioned that. I don't have amnesia. I remember those times, and I long for them, and I suffered with the people that were out of work during these times. I've seen the housing market go to free market, you know, the free market, like our right to work state in Wisconsin, which is what we call right to work for less. I never thought I'd see that in Wisconsin. And it happened. And I don't know where we were. I think that I know enough people. Maybe I'm just in confined circles, but a right to organize is a right, it's an inalienable right. It's a moral right. It's something that we all do. And yes, not always in unions. I'm with Voces de la Frontera. I'm with Justice for Immigrants. I'm with the Interfaith Committee for Detained Immigrants. I'm with a lot of groups and organizations that are quite powerful as a group. And that's what makes us strong. What it'll take to get them back, I don't know. If the union will ever... I don't know. You always need trained people on these buildings. I can't imagine putting people up there, and that's where all the accidents happen too, untrained people. And the unions train their workforce.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. We're going to move to more phone calls in just one moment, and there's a lot of territory to cover here. I think we do a whole show on unions, but our guest book covers a lot. We'll switch to tax codes and shifting the tax burden away from low-income and middle-income people. Greg on Facebook sends this message that Lucy Parson had it right then and even more true today. Her quote, never be deceived that the rich will allow you to vote away their wealths. If that's true, how do you change tax codes? Our guest this hour is the author of Plutocracy in America, How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the the poor. Ronald Formisano is with us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now. The email talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Could we talk before we go back? We have a full bank of phone lines, and I want to get to many of them, Professor Formisano. But can we talk about this change in the tax code that has taken place? It was a whole different ball of wax in the 1950s. Now we're looking at corporations not contributing that much to the GDP and the middle class having to pay a great deal. How do you change a tax code, and why is it that we've let it go so far from what it used to be, and many thought it was more equitable?
Well, there's a book by a veteran Washington reporter, Robert Kaiser, and the title of it is So Damn Much Money, and the subtitle is The Rise of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Democracy.
Hmm.
And I would just point to lobbyists as essentially the fourth branch of government. And corporations and those seeking tax breaks and all kinds of loopholes have been at it for decades with hundreds, thousands of lobbyists and lawyers working on their behalf, and economists call that rent seeking. They basically depend on special favors from the government to enrich themselves. And in the final part of my book, and I need to mention this because it's one of my favorite points that I make in the book, many rich conservatives look at what they call the undeserving poor. They shouldn't be getting government help. Well, there are some always undeserving people who exploit welfare or food stamps or whatever. And again, I point to, well, what kind of damage do those people do compared to the undeserving rich who walk away with billions, who commit criminal activities in the financial meltdown of 2008, 2009,
mm-hmm. Right.
And go unpunished and,
right.
and unpersecuted. I, by the way, your last caller, I loved hearing that Wisconsin accent again, and maybe he finds my East Coast accent charming. I don't know, but I enjoyed what he said, and I also agree that he doesn't have amnesia, but I would say that too much of the American public doesn't realize that when you stomp on unions, you're stomping on the middle class.
Jim in Rice Lake, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for having the show today. Professor, I repeatedly hear you referring to the middle class, and I'm hearing all sorts of political rhetoric about the middle class, and no one has defined the middle class. Is the middle class the same in Texas as it is in Minnesota? Or what is the criteria for the middle class, and how can you talk about it if you can't define it?
I think I can define it, but, of course, most people in this country, even some who earn $35,000 a year, regard themselves as middle class. If you look at the tax structure of Wisconsin, the second 20% of families earns $22,000 to $38,000 a year. I would say they're lower middle class. The next group earns up to about, the next two groups earn up to about, I think it's around $79,000 a year. I would call those people middle class. I would also point out that those people, each one of those groups, each one of that 20% group, from 22,000 on to around 90-something thousand, I could have that figure wrong. I just looked at it recently. They bear 10% of the tax burden in Wisconsin. The top 1% bears 6.2% of the tax burden in Wisconsin. Now, let's say that my definition of the middle class is somewhat amorphous and imprecise. Is that the point that matters? Or is the point that matters that those people in the middle are paying more than the 1%? So to me, the definition of the middle class, and you know, historians have written about this historically. When did the very phrase come into being? It came into being about two or three decades before the Civil War. It's always been imprecise. And sociologists would tell you there's two ways to measure the middle class. And I haven't looked at this stuff recently, but I did a long time ago. One is, I just referred to, there's a subjective definition. I talk about the middle class. I also want to point out that unlike politicians who are too chicken to talk about the poor, we should also be talking about those 47 million people that are in poverty. And unfortunately, Democratic politicians, for example, always will talk about the middle class, and the Republicans will talk about the middle class. They don't want to be accused of talking about the poor because then they might be accused of wanting to help immigrants. They might be wanting legal and those that are illegal, and they might be accused of wanting to help African Americans. So, what's the important point? The definition of the middle class or what a large group of people in the middle are paying, bearing the burden of the tax structure, and the 1% is doing a lot better.
I saw a report, and you know, you really wonder why this isn't a huge theme on the campaign trail. I can't remember if it was 53,000, maybe you'll remember, Professor, or 59,000 on what the average American household made last year. I think it was 53,000.
It was.
Down,
yeah,
was it 53? Down 6.7% from 2008 Great Recession. That's a big drop.
It's a very big drop. And again, that was reported on the day of the Republican debate, and no one talked about it.
Right.
And no one talked about the drought in California, which impacts, again, low-income people far more than it impacts high-income people. And over time, it's going to impact them even more. And that's something that the Pope, again, was talking about in his last encyclical. I don't pay any attention to that in my book. I wish I had. I think it calls for a second book.
Yes.
There's some very good books on climate change, such as Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything. I wish it did. But that's a brilliant book on climate change.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call, running short on time. Rick in Middleton, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I was wondering, this is just a what if we take this idea that the rich should share with the poor, which is effectively what I'm getting here, is that the 1% should not be so greedy and should disseminate. Would that, if the 1% were, let's say, Green Bay Packers, and they were going for the Super Bowl, would that team say, you know, the Minnesota Vikings are just not doing well, neither are the Bears. Maybe we should lose some games to help them. I don't think that would go. So in our conversations, in trying to establish some type of equality, if the mindset is, we're the Packers, we're going to go for the Super Bowl, we're going to win, we're going to crush all our opponents, then you're never going to get anywhere because their mindset is in a different place. And so the things coming out saying, you know, you should share this wealth with people. What are you going to do with $63 million a year? It's not coming across. Does my observation make sense?
And we have about 30 seconds, Professor.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm a fan of the Green Bay Packers, although my heart is with the New England Patriots, but I like the Packers quite a bit, just to let you know. And the NFL isn't our economy. And redistributive policies in this country would be good for the entire economy. It would be good for everybody. And, of course, the super rich really don't need much help. The 1%, the 0.01%, they really don't need any help. And they can pay their fair share. Warren Buffett talks about fairness. It's all about fairness. What's fair?
And on that note, we have to end. It's a good note to end on. What's fair? Our guest this hour, Ronald Formisano. His book is Plutocracy in America, How Increasing Inequality Destroys the Middle Class and Exploits the Poor. He's Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Kentucky. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this program and for doing on-air production. Until tomorrow.